From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Global warming, eco-friendly, carbon footprint, environmental justice. Those phrases and the environmental movement they reference have become increasingly mainstream. This is the 38th anniversary of Earth Day. We'll take a look at how the environmental movement affects African Americans. For people struggling to survive a tough economy, do they have time to care about being green? Can they afford not to care? Joining our discussion today is Monique Hardin. She's co-director of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights. We've also got Norris McDonald, president of the African American Environmentalist Association. Hi, folks.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, Monique, let me start with you. Being eco-friendly can be so trendy these days, but your group is looking at environmentalism from a legal and social justice framework. Tell me a little bit more about what you're up to.
Sure. Advocates for Environmental Human Rights. We're a public interest law firm based in New Orleans, and we're dedicated to changing legal systems that make communities of color vulnerable to disasters and displacement. One of those legal systems is what we call environmental protection.
And Norris, a lot of African Americans are living in areas near incinerators, toxic dumps, garbage landfills. What's your group doing to bring attention to toxic neighborhoods and how race can be a factor?
The primary thing we are doing is we're promoting national legislation, a National Environmental Justice Act of 2008, to provide a weapon, a way for communities to protect themselves. Right now, there are no protections in place. The Civil Rights Act will not work. The Presidential Executive Order on Environmental Justice will not work in a legal framework. So we have put together legislation that would solve the problem and would provide a tool for local communities to protect themselves. But there's also an incentive there for businesses. We call it a carrot. That is, that a project can also be endorsed if the community and the other authorities approve the project in advance of the actual permit.
What's the state of this legislation, this proposal? I mean, who are your allies in this?
Well, we are having a little trouble getting a sponsor for the legislation. Other legislation has been introduced that's actually more popular than our legislation. Congresswoman Solis from California has introduced another bill, but it basically codifies the presidential executive order, which is more of a federal agency cooperation and also advisory panels. Our legislation would actually put teeth into the situation, and there's been somewhat of a reluctance to then compete with the other more popular bill.
Well, Monique, let me go back to you. More specifics. Your group is located in New Orleans, and of course, the ramifications of Hurricane Katrina are still being felt there. What are you seeing on the ground in New Orleans?
Well, what's happening on the ground is a massive privatization that in particular affects African Americans and poor people. It keeps us from returning to the places we call home. And really bright spots of people from our communities taking leadership and building community clinics, Safeway Back Home projects to get people home. But it's a real undertaking because we've got a system that doesn't protect our right to recover. No one in the U.S. has the right to recover after a disaster, and that's part of the problem. That's central to the problem because our recovery has been turned into a promise. And an empty promise at that. And one of the things that we are fighting for with Advocates for Environmental Human Rights is making recovery a right. And I think the same goes for environmental justice, is that legislation needs to really be focused on the ways in which the current system violates human rights and how it can be changed and transformed so that people do have the right to health, the right to life, the right to racial equality and freedom from racial discrimination.
Specifically, what are neighborhoods dealing with? I mean, we have been, as a show, down to New Orleans several times and saw the city flooded and saw the houses filled with mold and all that, and also saw things like people planting sunflowers to try to leach toxins out of the soil in the Ninth Ward. What's being done right now to try to improve the environmental health of communities like the Ninth Ward?
Well, it's the communities themselves really taking leadership. In parts of the Ninth Ward, you have a sustainable green building for restoring and repairing and rebuilding housing of residents who were flooded out. because of the breach of the levees, not by Hurricane Katrina, is because of substandard levees. That's a real bright spot in an otherwise underwhelming situation that we have, where recovery is being perverted as privatization is being called recovery. But again, if you look at the Ninth Ward, there's a Holy Cross Neighborhood Association. It's a neighborhood group of folks who are going to be celebrating some new homes in the Ninth Ward that have been built with sustainable features and green building.
Let's talk, Norris, a little bit about what some folks are calling green-collar jobs in the green building and construction business, et cetera. What kind of jobs would fall under that umbrella?
Wind, solar, those sorts of installations, but also utility programs. Utilities are replacing electric meters. And actually, there were two conferences recently that discussed these issues. We are also co-sponsoring a conference that's going to not only address the green jobs issue, but a number of other environmental and environmental justice issues. The conference is being co-sponsored by Environmental Justice, Inc., several federal agencies, including the Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Interior, the Department of Agriculture, a number of grassroots activists. So it's a very unique conference. We had the first one last year. This will be the second one this year. And green jobs are very popular right now, and we really need to discuss those. We need to be talking to the utilities and others who are engaging in wind projects, trying to install photovoltaics. These sorts of areas will provide excellent employment for at-risk youth, maybe even ex-offenders. These are good electrician and plumbing jobs, and also very technical jobs. Some of the electronics involved in the smart meters.
Are African Americans looking for jobs positioned to go out for these green jobs? I mean, I know that Oakland, in conjunction with organizer Van Jones, has made some moves in that direction. But overall, are Black folks being considered or recruited for the kind of jobs you're talking about?
Well, that's the sort of thing we're promoting. We want to get the word out. That's the reason organizations such as ours exist. We know some of the mainstream groups are going to try to do some things, but we also want to try to get this word out so that the public is made aware. You know, the economy is going south on us right now, and this could provide a renaissance. I mean, not only can we protect the environment, but we can provide employment for low-income people, training for at-risk youth and people who really need the jobs while we are protecting Mother Earth.
What do you see, Monique? Do you see an opportunity? You talk about the community activism and people pulling together when they're not necessarily getting a lot of outside help in New Orleans. But do you see an opportunity for folks to enter some of these green jobs? And do you see people being recruited who are from New Orleans for these kinds of jobs?
Well, there certainly are opportunities. In New Orleans, the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice has for more than a decade have been training African-American men and women in green jobs and also finding employment opportunities as part of the training program that they offer. And so the opportunities certainly do exist, but I think one of the things we need to take a look at is not just market-based solutions, but really looking at the ways in which we can ensure that environmental protection actually does support human rights. If we had a system that protected the human rights to life, health, and racial equality, the idea of green jobs would already be on the board and well supported. But the tension that we have is that, on the one hand, green jobs and a sustainable building and sustainable energy and renewable energy is vying for space with the current system that is allowed for dirty, polluting facilities and oil refineries, coal-fired power plants, and the like. And we think both, efforts need to be made in both ways, both with the market-based solutions, but also legal solutions that changes the system.
Give me an example of what a success story is for you, something you've seen, Monique, or something that you know that another group has worked on. What does success in dealing with race and environmentalism mean to you?
Well, success stories that we've had have involved embracing a community struggle to convince regulatory agencies around protecting the community from a polluting source. It's also meant providing communities fighting for environmental justice with resources for controlling the development in their area and their neighborhoods. Those have been success stories.
Norris, what is a success story to you?
I think Omar Friella in New York, in the South Bronx, he has an organization called Green Worker Cooperatives, and they recycle products. They have a 17,000 square foot warehouse right now, and they're collecting all kinds of products, and they're modifying those and reselling them to the community. They're providing training, they're providing employment, and Omar has been at this for a long time. South Bronx has many, many issues there in New York. We have a local office in New York as well, and we're going to try to cooperate to the extent we can. But that's an excellent success story and model that Mr. Friella is doing in South Bronx.
And Norris, you know, there's all these technologies that can provide alternative energy like solar panels, but a lot of people, not just black folks, but a lot of people cannot afford these technologies. What can people do on an individual level? If you're someone who wants to make a difference, what can you do?
Well, you can do the traditional things such as the light bulbs and tighten up your house and weatherize your home. And to the extent you can, engage in some of the metering activities with your utility that you're going to offer. But, you know, we need to go beyond that on this 38th birthday of Earth Day. African-Americans and African-American entrepreneurs really need to get into ownership. Most of the light bulbs are actually made in China and they're hand twisted. We can get into some of these industries, and that's what we are promoting, is getting more ownership, more equity in not only the traditional energy areas, but in these emerging renewable energy areas.
Well, Norris, Monique, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We were speaking with Norris McDonald, president of the African American Environmentalist Association, and he joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C., and Monique Hardin, co-director of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This week on Africa Update, we're going to take a look at the escalating situation in Zimbabwe. It's been 3 weeks since the voters cast ballots for president. The results still haven't been released, and the plot thickens with questions about a recount, a re-vote, and an arms deal. For more, we've got Bill Fletcher. He's a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of Trans Africa Forum. Hey, Bill.
Hey, glad to be back.
Yes, always great to have you on. So let's dig into the election part first and then the arms deal. So the Zimbabwe Election Commission is keeping mum on these presidential ballots. They started recounting the ballots for 23 legislative seats. Now, the opposition party says the ruling party wants to rig the recount. So what's the state of this right now?
Well, it's a very odd situation, Fry. The Electoral Commission has refused to release the results, despite not only the request of the opposition, the Movement for Democratic Change, but an international call for the release of the results. But the Electoral Commission has been completely mum on this. And what makes this odder is that the government of President Mugabe then demanded a recount. So they demanded a recount on votes, yet they did not release the actual results. So the question was, what are they recounting and why? So that becomes a big problem. Secretary General Ban from the United Nations was recently meeting with the leader of the opposition, Morgan Tsvangirai, and he also put out a call for the Mugabe government to please release the results of the election.
Now, Morgan Tsvangirai, the opposition leader, has called on African leaders to acknowledge that he won the election. He also called President Mugabe a liberation hero and promised an honorable exit for him. But do you think that Mugabe or the military that still supports him is ready for any kind of exit?
I think that it was important that Morgan Tsvangirai acknowledged that President Mugabe had been a liberation hero. I think that it is difficult to imagine that the group around President Mugabe is prepared to exit. I don't think that there's any indications that they are. The problem is that there's very little that African governments first of all, let me back up. African governments cannot acknowledge that Morgan Tsvangirai won the election, in part because they don't know. They actually do not know whether he won the election. What they can do, however, is demand the release of the election results. And I think that that's very important. But the group around President Mugabe has very deep vested interests in remaining in power. And this is not simply ideological. We're talking about interests that include wealth, the results of Zimbabwe intervention in the civil war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for example. They're very reluctant to step down.
Now, has there been any kind of unrest or political violence since the elections in March?
There's been a great deal. And even the Zimbabwean police will acknowledge violence. They won't say who was behind the violence. The MDC claims that at least 10 of their members and supporters have been murdered. There have been reports from other groups like Human Rights Watch that there are detention centers that have been set up by the Zimbabwean government. Many of these are not confirmed, but it is fairly obvious that there's a great deal of violence. There's a great deal of fear that the violence will escalate and that we'll have a rerun of the situation in Kenya. And that's what makes this whole incident around the guns coming from China all that much more important.
So Zimbabwe is also making headlines for a related but different reason. There's a shipment of small arms coming from China that was scheduled to dock in South Africa. So tell us what happened to that shipment.
Well, this is fascinating. The Chinese ship loaded with 3 million rounds of small arms ammunition, 3,500 mortars and mortar tubes, and 1,500 rocket-propelled grenades was supposed to dock in Durban, which is on the east coast of South Africa. And from there, the arms were to be transported overland into Zimbabwe. And the South African Dock Workers Union, and we're talking about black workers, and I emphasize that because in the United States, sometimes the Zimbabwe situation is misreported in some significant ways. These are black dock workers refused to unload the ship. And they took a stand, which was consistent with the stand that the South African trade union movement has taken, that the situation in Zimbabwe is deplorable and that violence must cease. The Chinese ship then attempted to secure docking in Mozambique and Tanzania, and the governments there denied that. The ship was then reported to be heading towards Angola, and just moments ago it was reported that the ship may turn around and go back to China.
You know, the arms that we're talking about are valued at over $1 million. And it strikes me that Zimbabwe, the currency devaluation has been so severe, there has to also be a question about where that money came from compared to money that could be used for other purposes. I mean, when you look at the big picture of how this is playing out, what does it say about some of the struggles, not just in Zimbabwe, but the struggles about leadership and decision making that are plaguing various African nations?
Well, there's a couple of things about the arms. One is that these are the arms or the munitions that would be used by infantry, that is ground forces, against other ground forces. So in other words, and this may sound like a strange point, these are not weapons to defend against aircraft that might be attacking Zimbabwe from another country, for example. So the idea that this might be used in case the United States or Britain was trying to overthrow President Mugabe, no, these are weapons to be used on the ground. And I think that's what got the South African dock workers particularly unnerved by the possibility that this would be used to fuel a civil war. I think that it's not that there is no money in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe has a runaway inflation of over 100,000 percent. I mean, it's astronomical. But there is money in Zimbabwe, and there's money that's been collected by segments of the leadership. I think that what's so damaging about this, obviously, is that while the mass of the people of Zimbabwe are definitely suffering, there are those in the government who are putting away resources into their coffers, or in this case, putting away money that could be used for a military operation.
Do you think there could be an actual civil war? I mean, unlike South Africa, Zimbabwe did have a guerrilla war that ultimately overthrew the colonial government. Do you think that there could at some point be a civil war between factions in Zimbabwe?
I think that it's certainly possible. I think that what is more likely would be something that was along the lines of what took place in Kenya a few months ago with the type of semi-organized violence, but not conventional militaries involved. I think, though, that Zimbabwe, which is a very wealthy country in the sense of resources, the land, can step away from the precipice, but it will necessitate a real united front by African nations to meet with the parties and to impress upon President Mugabe that there must be democratic change, there must be a transition, and that this current situation simply cannot be allowed to continue, because in this situation, what you'll have then is more heated rhetoric, particularly from the United States and Britain, could be encouraging people towards war.
All right, Bill, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of Trans-Africa Forum. He spoke with us from NPR's Washington headquarters. Now to East Africa. It's been 3 years since the government of Sudan signed a peace agreement with a rebel group called the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. Since then, an estimated 2 million southern Sudanese have returned home. They'd fled to other parts of Sudan or to neighboring countries. Melanie Teff works with Refugees International, a Washington, D.C.-based humanitarian organization. She recently visited South Sudan and says women returning home face a specific set of challenges.
Returnees are coming back to a situation of very little. Basically, South Sudan was in a state of civil war for over 20 years, in a war with the North, and everything has been destroyed. The place is really devastated, and so there's a total lack of basic services. So villages, which were just about supporting the populations that they had before, are now coping with doubling or trebling in size. And so services like clean water and schooling and health centres. And one could ask, well, why does that particularly hit the women? Well, it's the women who, because of their traditional role in South Sudanese society, are the ones who take responsibility as caregivers for their families. It's the women who are lining up at water boreholes, waiting in line for huge amounts of time and getting into conflicts between other women because of the limited resources. And it's the women who are left with having to cope with hungry children, with children who aren't getting medication in clinics, and with children who are not able to get the education that maybe they were getting when they were in exile.
You've met with many of these women. Give me an example of one person's story that exemplifies to you some of these challenges.
I met with a woman in a village called Malawal Bay. She told me that she'd been living in Khartoum, in the capital of the North Sudan, for 20 years. I asked her, why did you come back? And she said, well, I was told it was peaceful at home. I've been waiting for so many years to be able to return to my home, and now it's possible, so I came back. She received a food ration from the UN World Food Programme of 3 months, which she was very grateful for. But she hoped at that time she was going to get seeds and tools so that she would be able to cultivate a piece of land and become self-sufficient. But that didn't happen at the time. And so she and her family used up their three-month food ration, and the 3 months had passed, and she was very depressed at this point, pointing out that during the war, people in the village actually got more assistance than is now happening during the peace. She was emphasising to me that she didn't want to be dependent on food aid handouts. She was very clear that she and the other women in the village wanted to be self-sufficient, but they needed a hand up at the start. She also talked about the difficulty for her children, because her children had grown up in the north, which is Arabic-speaking. And now, moving back to her village, it was an English-speaking schooling system. And her children, there was no help for her children to be able to make the transition. And she talked about her fears of, if her children get sick, that there really wasn't medication in the health clinic. She said if they get sick at the beginning of the week, they've got a chance. But if, say, they get malaria at the end of the week, then she was very scared that they would die of such a preventable illness.
Now, when you think about what you're doing with the very basics of human survival, what about the opportunities for advancement of women's rights? Is that even possible?
Actually, despite these difficult conditions that I'm describing, this is, in fact, very much a moment of hope for women in southern Sudan. One of the opportunities at this moment is the 2005 interim constitution of southern Sudan. And it has landmark rights for women in it. It includes the promotion of women's participation in public life. It includes, importantly, a minimum political representation quota in government of 25%. This is really quite remarkable in South Sudan, which is a very traditional society in which women have not been recognized as political leaders in the past. Another point, I think, that makes this a moment of hope is with women returning home from exile, you have a situation where women have been living for many years in countries where they've got used to having more recognition of women's rights. So, for example, there were many Sudanese women lived in Kenya in refugee camps for years. They're coming back now, and those women learnt to take on leadership roles in the refugee camps in Kenya. And they expect more from women's roles when they return to Sudan. Also, with the interim constitution, the government of South Sudan has started to make some concessions towards women. For example, we met with Ms. Rebecca Garang, who has the post of gender advisor to the president of Southern Sudan. There's also a Ministry of Women. This starts to show a recognition of the importance of women's rights. The difficulty is that even having a 25% minimum quota doesn't mean that you can fill the 25% quota, because the lack of education for girls in the past means there's a real need to build up women's capacity so that they can start taking up those roles. As one woman politician said to me, if we, the women, don't take up the roles, the men are going to get in there and take up those posts before we do. So that's a step forward. But the problem we saw was that women are starting to take up these posts in Juba, in the capital of South Sudan, but it's not getting down to the local level. Women in positions of power don't get out to the villages enough. They're very potentially very powerful role models. And it's important that this moment of opportunity for women shouldn't just be in the capital.
When you talk about this, you sound incredibly excited by the potential. What is it that you would like to see unfold? And particularly given that you are an outsider, what would you like to see unfold as a partnership between people like you who come from outside of the country and the culture and people who are within the country and the culture?
Well, I met with women's groups who had amazing initiative, local women's groups, who were in the most difficult of circumstances trying to rebuild their communities. For example, we met with one women's group who were producing handmade bricks in incredibly hot conditions. They hadn't received food to sustain them, but they were motivated to be building by hand a women's centre and a returnee centre to welcome back returnees. This is remarkable to see this sort of initiative in such difficult conditions. However, they pointed out to me that they could do so much, but they needed roofing materials. Without roofing materials, when the rains come in the rainy season, it will all be washed away, their work. And that seemed to me to be an example of the sort of local women's group that needs to be supported, that groups like that can participate as they want to in the reintegration and recovery process. It's very important that the government of Southern Sudan, with the support of the international community, give support to local women's groups like these.
Well, Melanie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Melanie Teff is with Refugees International. She recently returned from a trip to southern Sudan, where she helped with returning refugees and the advancement of women's rights. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Holly Robinson Pete has been in the spotlight since she was a preschooler on Sesame Street. She went on to star in the 80s hit series 21 Jump Street. She shared the screen with Johnny Depp and with Stephen Williams, who played Captain Adam Fuller.
So tell me about him. How's he look up close? Nobody really has cheekbones like that. I believe Jeremy Woods is totally fine. He's hot. I let the guy eat crackers in my bed. Why didn't I get this assignment?
That is why.
Pete also starred in the sitcom Hangin' with Mr. Cooper and played Diana Ross on a TV miniseries. Today she hosts a radio show and heads a foundation for Parkinson's disease awareness. Pete still won't slow down. She's just written the foreword to Book of Life, a collection of contemporary words of wisdom from mothers like herself. She and I spoke earlier about how she faces some of her life challenges, including her son's autism.
The most key factor to making your best days happen is to breathe, is to just take in the moment. Anytime we hit a challenge or if I'm feeling tremendously stressed, I'll do a spa day or I'll take a yoga class or I'll just do something that focuses on myself. And the Book of Life, Making Your Best Days Happen, I wrote a foreword talking about our challenges with autism and how that brought us together as a family. You know, it's no secret that the divorce rate with autism is about at 80%. So when we got that diagnosis in 1999, we came across a lot of challenges. So we managed to take a bad thing, a thing that really felt like it could potentially tear us apart as a couple and as a family, and we turned it into something positive.
So there's this book that mm-hmm. is designed to reach other mothers. And there's been a lot of focus right now on the challenges that people face with kids who have special needs, whether it's mm-hmm. autism or other things. In a way, is it a good time? It may sound strange, but is it a good time to be someone with these challenges?
I know exactly what you're saying, and I am not kidding. I just said that to somebody this morning, that at least, at the very least, we are talking about some of the challenges, especially with autism. I think basically what's happening is, had we had these challenges 20 years ago, we would have had little access to any resources, and it would have been a much more difficult landscape. But now we have the internet, we have people more open to talking about certain things, we have more information, and I think it is a positive time. There's still people out there struggling with it, but the positive is that, yes, it's a very good time to talk about, or if you get this diagnosis of autism, it's not the end of the world. There are treatments that we didn't even know about when we got our diagnosis, 8 or 9 years ago. So there's some positive things happening right now.
You've also been able in the past to turn some of the challenges that you faced into outreach to other people. And I'm thinking of your father who passed mm-hmm. away from Parkinson's, mm-hmm. which degenerates the nervous system and eventually causes death. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it was horrific to watch him go through that. But at the same time, you were able to take that and turn it into a foundation. Tell us a little bit about how you decided to take the inspiration from your father's passing and turn it into something positive.
Well, actually, the inspiration came before he passed away, when he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease when he was only in his 40s. I was a freshman in college, and I was wondering what this limp was. He was limping. And my father was the original Gordon on Sesame Street, and if you're sort of between 30 and 40 plus, you remember him as the very original Gordon. And he's just a brilliant man. He went on to write and produce The Cosby Show for the whole run of the show, and wrote a lot of sitcoms. And one of the sitcoms that he was a writer on was Sanford and Son. And I remember being at Sarah Lawrence College in the early 80s and watching my daddy. He dropped me off at school and he walked away from me and he was limping. And I said, "Hey, Dad, why are you walking like Fred Sanford?" And my dad, who was very, very funny and quick on his feet, was saying, "Listen, don't worry about me. You just do your studies and pay attention in class, or you'll be running a junkyard too." And we laughed about it and he kind of played it off. But when I came home for Christmas that year, he had a case of Bell's palsy and his face was slouchy. And that's when we got the diagnosis that he had Parkinson's. He was only 46 years old. So for about 10 years, I was sort of in denial, in this really ugly slump about the situation. But when I met my husband, he told me that we need to help people with this disease. So that's how the Holly Rod Foundation got started. And we basically help elevate the quality of life of people with Parkinson's. And then as we got the diagnosis for autism, we sort of incorporated that within our mission. And we have what's called Holly Rod for Kids, where we help raise money for the quality of life of children as well.
All right, before we let you go, I have to ask about 21 Jump Street. There, you have done some, you've done so many amazing things in life, you know, playing Diana Ross, all these things that people would consider a dream. But, being in the demo that I am in, which is the same demo you mentioned around Sesame Street, I totally adore 21 Jump Street. What did you learn from doing that? And do people still come up to you and talk to you about it?
Everywhere I go, someone remembers 21 Jump Street. And then, of course, there are the younger generation, like the tween set. Like my kids, it's not really on their radar. When they think of Johnny Depp, they think of, you know, the whole Pirates series. And, you know, they're like, wow, you were in a movie with you were in a TV show with Captain Jack Sparrow. And so people still really love it. And I really felt like we were a groundbreaking show. We shot everything on location in Canada. It was just a young, heady time. We had everyone on the show before they were stars, from Brad Pitt to Jada Pinkett Smith and many others. And it was, I believe, a show that was ahead of its time.
One more thing, your radio show. What's it like doing a radio show with your husband?
Well, radio, I have to say, is a little different animal than TV. I thought it was going to be super easy. We do it out of our house. It's on XM 156. We're on a show called Meet the Peets with Oprah and Friends, and we talk about everything from politics to parenting. I thought, oh, I can roll out of bed, don't have to put on any lashes, no makeup, lipstick, just roll out of bed and do this show. But it's a lot more work than I thought. You have to talk to your husband every day for an hour. And we have to be getting along too. If we're not getting along that day, it makes for a long hour. So the wonderful part of it, well, just like I'm talking to you now, the wonderful part of it is that we do it from home, and my 3-year-old can walk in as he just walked in. And it's one of those really interesting, very interesting things. But I'm loving radio, and I encourage people to check us out on XM 156. Can you say hi? Sure, say hi.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm Roman.
My name's Roman.
It's good to talk to you. Have a great day.
Say see you later.
See you later.
That's the best cameo you could ever ask for, and so we know you have 4 guests that you can get on short notice.
Yeah, as a matter
your
of fact,
kids.
They pulled a coup on us the other day. They said, well, the show's called Meet the Peets, and they really haven't met us too much. The 4 kids are like, why can't we be on? I know. So I promised them once a month they get a little appearance, and so they've been doing their prep work for that.
Oh, that's fabulous. Well, on that note, Holly, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate the conversation.
Actress Holly Robinson-Peet wrote the introduction for Book of Life, Making Your Best Days Happen. She's also the co-founder of the Holly Rod Foundation, which deals with Parkinson's disease awareness. Holly joined me from her home studio in Los Angeles. Downtown Los Angeles is a series of micro-neighborhoods. One minute you're by the glamorous historic Biltmore Hotel. A few blocks away, there's a tent city set up on Skid Row. Los Angeles Times columnist Steve Lopez was strolling through downtown when he saw a homeless man playing classical violin. His name, Lopez discovered, is Nathaniel Ayers. And in addition to musical talent, Nathaniel has schizophrenia. Lopez now has a new book about Ayers called The Soloist, A Lost Dream, An Unlikely Friendship, and the Redemptive Power of Music. Jamie Foxx will play the musician in an upcoming biopic also called The Soloist. Steve Lopez says he and Nathaniel are good friends now, but Lopez says it took a while for Nathaniel to warm to him.
But I went back several times, and each time that I visited, he was a little warmer, a little more open, a little more talkative. And he said, yes, he knew that a violin has 4 strings, and his whole goal in life was to get another 2 strings, but he didn't know how that was going to happen because he did not like to accept money for his playing. And I did notice that about him. He didn't seem to be playing with a hat out collecting dollar bills. He was playing as if he was trying to get something just right. So one day when I visited, he had scrawled some names on the sidewalk. I forget exactly what the names were, but like Betty and Robert and Tom and Sally, and I said, well, who are they? And he said, those were my classmates at Juilliard. I ran back to my office, called Juilliard, hoping that it was true, but I knew by this point that he said things sometimes that didn't quite make sense and were somewhat delusional. I knew that there was a mental condition of some type. I didn't have enough experience to know what it might be. And when I got back and called, Juilliard said, no, we're sorry, there's no record of him. And I was just crestfallen, and I thought, well, do I even have a column? This guy is so so bad off that, you know, he's imagining that he went to Juilliard. They called back the next day. They had made a mistake. Yes, indeed, Mr. Nathaniel Anthony Ayers had been a student for 3 years at Juilliard in the late 60s and early 70s, and I was just thrilled. And I ran back out there, and he was just very nonchalant about it. Yeah, of course I went to Juilliard.
How much do you feel that you played a role in helping him reconnect with people who could not only give him strings to his instrument, but also some kind of sense of belonging to a community of musicians?
Well, I didn't know what I was doing, to tell you the truth. I was really just, you know, by the seat of my pants on this thing. I did know from the very beginning that when he was playing music, that was his sanctuary. And I did know that maybe I can speak to him through the music by just asking him. And every time we would talk about music, there would be less of the sort of non sequiturs and the gibberish. It would kind of center him. And when I wrote the first column, readers donated instruments. So, yes, you know, seeing me come back out to him that day with all of those violins that people had donated reconnected him with his music. And he really began to trust me at that point. He thought that I was, you know, some angel had come down from heaven to visit him with these gifts. So all of that mellowed him, and in that part of our relationship, things were going really well, and the music made a big difference. And as I continued to write about these things, among the developments were an invitation from Disney Hall to go up and see a concert. And I talked to Mr. Ayers about it, and he said that he didn't think he wanted to go. And I said, Mr. Ayers, when I first met you, you had written on your shopping cart, Little Walt Disney Concert Hall. And now here's a chance to go to Big Walt Disney Concert Hall. Why wouldn't you want to do this? And he said, well, you know, I don't think I'd be comfortable, and I don't think people would be comfortable around me. And I said, why not? And he said, well, you know, I haven't bathed, and I can't even remember how long it's been. And people shouldn't have to pay good money to go to a concert to see great classical music and be distracted by the likes of me. And I said, well, I respect that. But I had another idea. I called Adam Crane, the publicist for the L.A. Philharmonic, and I said, hey, Adam, how about if we came to a rehearsal? Would that be acceptable? And Adam said, well, let me check, and called back and said, sure, why not? So we went to a rehearsal of Beethoven's Third Symphony, and that was sort of a breakthrough moment for us. And he re-entered the fraternity of musicians for real on that visit. He had members of the orchestra come and greet him, and they were thrilled to meet him, and he was even more thrilled to meet them, and they had conversations that were so far over my head. So I was there like a proud parent, and I'm just dumbfounded as I stood back and watched. He was home when he got to meet up with these musicians.
It sounds like your friendship, and you describe it as a friendship with Nathaniel Ayers, has transform not only his life, but yours as well.
Well, it has. I mean, he, you know, now I buy classical music now. and I didn't before, and I've developed an appreciation for it. Mr. Ayers on most days calls me. We see each other once or twice a week, but when we don't, he usually calls or I call him. And the other thing that he did that was critical for me was that I work in what looks to all of us who are in newspapers like a dying industry. And it's tough sometimes to maintain your edge because there's a revolution underway. It's dying. And I thought, I'm 54. If I've got 10 years left or maybe 15, do I want to spend it reminiscing about the good old days? Or shouldn't I go out and do something in the field of mental health? Why don't I do something like that? Why don't I do something with the rest of my career in that field? And Mr. Ayers was one of the people who kind of talked me out of it. And he said, you know, music is his passion, but words are mine, and I can't leave that. I've got to stick with that. And I thought, you know, I'm writing the story of my career with Mr. Ayers, the friendship, and my reporting on it is fulfilling in so many ways, unlike anything I've ever done, he has re-sparked my own passion in what I do for a living. And I'm going to be the last one out of the building. I'm going down with the ship if it goes down. That's what I do. I tell stories. And the greatest gift I've gotten from Mr. Ayers is that he let me get close enough to tell his story.
How's he doing now?
Okay, he has, it took a year to talk him in off the streets and take an apartment. And he did that, and he's been in the apartment for 2 years, a little over 2 years. And his day is to go and do a little bit of work and then probably play some music. And we're in touch about our next adventure. And sometimes he really drives me a little crazy because of either the demands or he gets angry about things. But most of the time, these outings are just wonderful. And he's not in good enough shape, nor is his playing quite there yet, to be in, say, a community orchestra. This was a young man in training who had his fall when he was 21, so he had a little more polishing to do. But he's pushing me to get a recording studio. It's kind of hard for me to tell him right now that I'm not sure that he's ready to put out a CD. But it's wonderful to see a man with these passions and these goals. And, you know, he's very happy when he's got music on his mind.
Well, Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Novelist and Los Angeles Times columnist Steve Lopez, his new book about Nathaniel Ayers, a musical prodigy who later had a breakdown and developed schizophrenia, is called The Soloist, A Lost Dream, An Unlikely Friendship, and the Redemptive Power of Music.